Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, a monthly show on Radio Reverb about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. On this month's show, we are joined by bookseller extraordinaire Elizabeth Perry to talk truth, memory and reliability in fiction. We ask, but certainly don't answer, the questions, are all stories to an extent true? This episode is jam-packed with great recommendations, which I've listed in the show notes, as well as over on our Instagram page. Later on in the show, we talk to Aflo the Poet about their event series in collaboration with Brighton Dome called Status Flow, a new night of spoken word featuring fresh local talent and special guests from across the UK. You can follow us on Instagram at BTN Book Club, and if you have a suggestion for the show, please do email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Enjoy! We have something a little bit different for you this month, and I am joined by Elizabeth Perry. Now, anyone that's listened to the show for a while will know how much I love getting Elizabeth on every year to talk about her book recommendations and suggesting something that you may not have heard of. Elizabeth and I met when she was working at City Books in Brighton, and Elizabeth now works at Daunt Books in Oxford, and I'm really excited to be actually sitting next to Elizabeth as we talk about books, and she's one of my favourite people to talk about books with. No recommendation. Nothing she's ever recommended has not been wonderful. So we're all in for an absolute treat today. And I said to Elizabeth, right, what do you want to be talking about? What really interests you? I want to hear it. And Elizabeth wants to talk about truth, memory, and reliability in fiction. So I hope you enjoy this lively discussion about one of the most thought-provoking and controversial subjects in literature. Elizabeth, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much. That was so lovely. I'm feeling under pressure for all these books to be good.
Well, no pressure, but I would love to know why you wanted to talk about this subject in particular.
Well, that's a very good question. I write this newsletter called Shelf Improvement, and the way I do that is I recommend 5 books on a theme. So when it comes to recommendations, I'm often thinking about themes. And truth generally is kind of one that I keep coming back to in different ways in the instalment, whether that's like in memoir or in politics or things like this. And I just think there's so much to talk about in there, and you can go in lots of different directions. But in particular, we had an event at the shop a few weeks ago where two authors were talking about a memoir, but it got onto the topic of the difference between fiction and memoir. And one of them said she felt that fiction could sometimes be true, but it wasn't always real, or always wasn't real, and real was what memoir was. And I just thought that was so interesting, and I haven't stopped thinking about it. And the more I thought about it, the more books came to mind, ones that I really loved, ones that I found really interesting to talk about. So it just felt like a good jumping off point.
Absolutely. And I think there are so many layers of things to talk about, you know, not only the ethics of writing truth, but also the kind of the fact of nonfiction as one person's specific truth and fiction as also specific truths. And it's a much grayer area than I think, you know, we're often led to believe by the shelves in a bookshop, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So do you want to kick us off?
Yes. The one I think I'm going to start with is a novel called Hazardous Spirits by Ambara Slam. And it was actually Ambara who said this about fiction and truth and reality and things. And I can really see that coming through in this novel in particular, which is set in like 1920s Edinburgh. And it's narrated by this woman who's got a very reliable husband. He's always been really, in quote marks, normal. And then all of a sudden he is convinced he can talk to ghosts, and he can, like, seances he's going to and things like this. And she's not really sure. Already I'm thinking about the words true and real, and I can't use them the way I want to. She's not sure if ghosts are real, but obviously when it comes to ghost stories, a lot of the time, real is so subjective. Like, if you believe you've seen one,
mm-hmm.
there's not really a way of verifying whether it was real or not.
No.
Because if you believe enough, I guess it's real but not true.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's so complicated.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'm thinking about, you know, the way that we talk to children when they say that they've seen something, or, you know, it's like, do you want to discount that? Because how much is imagination? And then how real is imagination? Or is it true but not real?
Yeah, completely. And this is a really big part of the book. So as Evelyn kind of gets more sucked into what her husband's now doing, it kind of becomes quite a big money maker. So there's this money element involved. And if his, what would you call them? If his skills mm-hmm. are real, then there's a financial benefit to them being real. So there's also this element of, is he aware? And is he doing this as a kind of job?
Mm-hmm.
Does he really believe, and the money is just a kind of benefit? And for Evelyn, she thinks it's all crazy. But she's kind of torn between what could be the possible... There's kind of two options for her. Either her husband is crazy, or her husband is lying to her. This is where she's kind of stuck. She's like, either I don't trust him to be rational, or he is and he's lying to me, and she can't decide which one's worse.
Gosh, that sounds so good.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really good.
And is it conclusive?
It's not really, no. It's so tempting to talk in detail about the ending, which I'm not going to do, but there's an element of that true versus real. Like, if he has had a conversation with a ghost and he believes it,
mm-hmm.
how relevant is it that that might not have actually taken place? It might not be real, but it could be true. The feelings could be true. The things he's learned, quote marks, from this conversation mm-hmm. that affect his relationship, it's going to have an impact. And so how much can you ever really know?
Absolutely. That really kind of makes me think about the canon of literature about relationships and couples lying to each other and or not quite telling the truth to each other. Is there anything that really springs to mind as good literature about relationships where people are lying to each other?
Oh, that's such a good question. There's one book that I read recently called After She Wrote by Solari Gentile.
Okay.
Which it's so hard to talk about, and I can't recommend it straightforwardly because the ending drove me nuts. but my partner's reading it now and I'm so desperate to discuss it with him. So I think it's worth reading, even if I kind of got quite annoyed at the ending, I suppose. But it's about there's a writer who's writing a character who's a literary fiction writer,
mm-hmm.
and he's writing a commercial writer, and that's her. So they're kind of, I know already it's confusing. She's writing this novel about a literary fiction writer.
Right.
And then you get chapters from his perspective, and he's writing a novel about a crime writer.
So there are a couple of writers.
Well, one of them's in the other's book, basically.
Whoa.
Yeah, yes. So Madeline is creating this character, and she's in a loving marriage,
mm-hmm.
But she's kind of falling in love with this character she's creating. He's quite like enigmatic and handsome, obviously, because
sure.
he's a fantasy. But then the chapters from his perspective, he's writing this crime fiction writer. So each of them are kind of exploring mysteries in their own storylines. But it's kind of like that picture of the hand drawing itself. It's like you're not entirely sure who's the real writer or if either of them are real writers.
Wow.
And then it turns out, not to give away too many spoilers, but both of them in their own relationships, there's a lot of lies happening. So even when the storylines are written from their perspective, which you could say is like their memoir bits,
mm-hmm.
they don't have all the information. And so what they're telling you is misleading, but they don't know it yet.
God, that sounds really good and really meta. Can you remind me of the name of that book?
Yeah, it's called After She Wrote Him.
Amazing. That's a great title. Right, what is next on our list?
I think that's a good place to go into Margot's Got Money Troubles by Ruthie Thorpe.
It's a very good title.
It's such a good title and it's such a good book. So this is a novel and the premise is Margot, she's quite young, I think she's in her early 20s. She's just had a baby with her college professor who doesn't want to be involved and she's got money troubles. And so she decides to start this OnlyFans and she enlists the help of her dad, who's an ex-pro wrestler.
Wow,
I'm hooked. Jinx. Oh, it's so good. And Jinx, he's a bit taken aback by the plan, but then he kind of gets on board. And he uses what he's learned in wrestling and creating storylines in a kind of soap opera way, like little installments of continuing stories. And that's what they apply to Margot's OnlyFans. So there's this kind of ongoing storyline that's quite wacky.
Wow.
It's quite experimental. But she is, to various people in her life, lying or not telling full truths.
Mm-hmm.
And so are some of the other characters. So Jinx is also hiding something from her. But I guess the kind of central tension of the book comes from the fact that this college professor who got her pregnant and then kind of dipped comes back and he's trying to sue for custody because of her OnlyFans. So she's trying to find a way of keeping her child in her life. She's also making quite good money. She's also getting kind of famous. And there's all these different elements of the various stories you tell about yourself and the various stories that people will tell about you and where they might conflict and in a very real way affect your life.
God, that's such a good and timely idea. But it reminds me of what you were just saying, actually, about the first book that we spoke about money, actually, yeah. And how once capitalism becomes a part in truth and lies,
yeah.
how do they warp?
Yeah, I think that's a question that the book is thinking about a lot and maybe is a kind of, by extension, it's a question about writing generally. If you want to write what feels true to you, but you also need to sell a book, where do those things come into conflict?
Absolutely.
And something that Ruthie Thorpe does in this book is there's two tenses. So Margot sometimes uses I to talk about herself, but sometimes she refers to Margot. So kind of there's a bit of distance when she's talking about the things that she maybe finds harder to accept that she did, or there's lots in it about, I guess, responsibility and when it's harder to accept responsibility for the things that you've done. And a lot of that is tied into money and like where she's had to make decisions for financial reasons and where they've maybe been quite good decisions, but the way other people feel about them is what then becomes the problem.
God, that is great. And I mean, and then I guess leads us, and I'm sure we'll move on to talk about this, about the whole idea of, you know, for want of a better phrase, Instagram versus reality, you know, reality TV versus reality, you know, and the real kind of, you know, true crime and all of these things that are kind of real but not real,
yeah.
and created for entertainment purposes.
Completely. And I think about that a lot with reality TV and the idea of some of it being scripted. I guess in a lot of ways, like wrestling. Do you know much about
like
wrestling?
A small amount about wrestling, but I love that you know about wrestling.
Well, I knew nothing until this book, really. But it took me a long time to realise that they're not real fights. Well, already I've said something that's going to upset wrestling fans. They're predetermined.
Sure.
But it's kind of like improv.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like a boxing match. I thought wrestling was like a boxing match.
Like
and there could
sport.
Be
sport.
Yes.
Am I gonna get in trouble for saying wrestling is not a sport? Oh, maybe.
Most surprising people are big wrestling fans. And it's through them that I learned a lot of this stuff. But there's bits in the book where someone sort of says wrestling's fake and Jinx gets quite, he says it's not fake, like it's real, it's predetermined. but it's not fake.
Yeah, and what is fake?
Exactly. I think with this conversation, I think it's really important to recognise we're talking about truth and reality in art.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other areas where facts are facts, like politically, the earth is not flat kind of thing. Like we
Wait,
can...
what?
You didn't know.
I didn't.
So it is, I think, to responsibly have this conversation, you do kind of have to remember that we're talking about art,
yeah,
if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
But yeah, what I mean in that case, like, what is real and what is fake? I don't know what the answer is.
I don't know. Should we move on to the next book, yes, before we have an existential crisis?
Freak ourselves out.
And I just need to just do some research about the shape of the earth.
Yes, I am joking. You do. Okay, so the next one is My Good Bright Wolf by Sarah Moss. And this one is a memoir. And the epigraph, so you know the beginning of the book where there's like a little quote that introduces it all. One of them says, "All stories are true."
Mm.
Which I think is a really interesting first point for a memoir. And this one is thinking about Sarah's childhood, her experiences of anorexia when she's a teenager, and then more recently in the pandemic as an adult, having a relapse and being hospitalised again. But she's looking at her childhood in quite a lot of detail, as well as the books that she read at the time and how it's kind of informed her sense of self, maybe, but also what that does to your idea of yourself as a person in a body, with a body that people see and have thoughts and feelings and opinions about. And so one of the things that comes up a lot is the idea of contested memory. So she thinks she remembers things accurately, but maybe members of the family feel differently. And I heard her talk about the book, and in it, one of the examples she gave was that she remembers as a child getting frostbite, getting hypothermia, and she remembers being in the doctor's like waiting room for it, and members of her family say, "You didn't have it." And she had to decide, would she go back and look at her medical records, or would she just decide, for me, like, I don't need to verify my true stories. And so she didn't go back and verify.
Interesting.
She just decided to believe herself, which I found really quite emotional to hear, that idea of memory can be contested, but it's okay to just decide to believe yourself about it. Or maybe,
yes,
that's the most important thing to
in
do.
Art, of course.
Yes.
And I think that this is why, and I'm really glad that you mentioned that a minute ago, because, you know, I'm thinking with everything, with the US election and all,
yeah,
these things going on at the moment, and I'm like, no, some things are facts.
Facts are facts.
Art is so different, right? Mm. And writing is so different. That's there's this lovely line, all stories are true. And that just really is really powerful to me.
Yeah.
Because they're also all true, but they're also all stories. And by the fact that they're stories, they're made up, right?
Yeah, yeah. And what does that mean when you're talking about memoir,
mm-hmm,
as well? Or Sarah said she liked life writing,
mm-hmm,
as a phrase more than memoir, because I guess... Well, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about the difference between the two words. And I think maybe this is quite a, like... writer's thing. Like, I think to most readers, the
yeah,
two
they
are
just want a good book.
yeah. But what does it mean to call a memoir true?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
very interesting. Right, what do we have next on the list?
The next book I want to talk about is The Hypocrite by Jo Hamier, which I just had so much fun reading. It's a brilliant premise. So you've got two central characters, a father who's quite a successful novelist and his daughter Sophia, and there's two timelines in it. You've got, I think it's 2010, let me double check, yeah, 10 years before the present day events. Sophia's 16, they've gone on holiday to Sicily, and she's being dictated to his new novel. So she's writing his novel, as in physically writing it.
Right, okay.
And...
At 16?
Yeah.
You couldn't have got me doing that at 16.
No, I know. Yeah. And the pair of them, I think you could probably say their relationship fractures quite a lot, but I'm not sure the father notices at the time.
Okay.
And lots of things happen. Sophia's kind of having her first crush. Her father is inviting lady friends over and she's mm-hmm. aware of it. So there's all this kind of stuff going on about relationships and power and things. And then the present day Strand, 10 years later, Sophia's first play is opening in London. And her father has arrived for the matinee. It's a very hot afternoon. He sits down in the theatre. The curtains go up. And he realises the play is based on that holiday. He recognises the set and realises he's the subject of the play.
Oh, my God. I love this. Yeah. I love it.
It's so good. And so you've got this afternoon unfolding. Sophia and her mother are nearby in a restaurant. And the mother knows what the play's about. And is kind of like, well, I told you this would feel weird. Like, you're nervous about seeing him afterwards. Of course mm-hmm. you are. You wrote a play about him. And I don't feel bad for you at all. And Sophia's kind of stressing about the dinner she's going to have with her father when he gets out. And it's intercut with these moments of the father in the play. Watching this version of himself that he takes issue with. But then you also get elements from the holiday. So you can see where the two of them are remembering the same thing differently, mm. or maybe Sophia has noticed something and interpreted it one way and he would disagree with that interpretation. And rather than having a conversation about it, this is happening on a stage in a sold out theatre.
God, it's so juicy.
Yeah,
I love that.
It's so good. It's just fantastic. And there's all these little conversations that really illuminate how the two of them feel. So for most of it, Sophia is talking to her mother, and though I love those scenes, they're very stressful actually. But then, like, the father has an argument with someone in the crowd during the interval who's read his books and doesn't like them because of how he talks about women. And she kind of says something to him about, I can't remember the specifics, but essentially sort of saying he's a misogynist. And he's talking about how, well, if you read the between the lines of anything I've written, you know there's nothing to be upset about. Like, this isn't who I am in my real life.
Mm.
Which is very interesting dynamic, the whole, like, separating the art from the artist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That sounds like such a great book. Can you remind us of the title?
It's called The Hypocrite by Jo Hamier. And I guess the kind of question it's asking is Sophia or her father a hypocrite, or are both of them hypocrites?
Yes, and are all writers hypocrites?
Yeah.
Who knows? So I would love to talk to you about something that I've been thinking about recently, and it's a discussion that came up in my writing group about writing. This was based on a conversation about Curtis Sittenfeld writing about the young Hillary Clinton in her book Rodnam. Do you want to give us a bit of an overview of that book for anyone that isn't aware of it, and then we'll kind of talk about the ethical implications of that?
Yeah, okay. So this book it's a novel, and it is imagining what would happen if Hillary Clinton hadn't married Bill Clinton and had stayed Hillary Rodham. And so the story goes that Bill proposed to her 3 times, and on the 3rd time she said yes.
Mm-hmm.
But in Curtis's novel, the 3rd time she still says no. And then she goes on to have her own political career, as does Bill, and it takes us up to the version of present day. So, like, there's a version of Trump in there, there's a version of Hillary and Bill as they are now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different, and the way things have panned out for them both is different.
Now, how do you feel ethically about authors writing about people who are still alive?
I do not know. I think I often feel quite uncomfortable. I think there's so much that would reassure me, like, was that person involved? Do they like the version? But then at the same time, sometimes books are written about people who wouldn't like the version, but the version needs to be told, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I think on the whole, I find it quite difficult. And when it comes to something like Rodham in particular, where so much fact and fiction is blurred, so it's not even a novelized version of her life. It's like bits of it are true or real, and then bits of it are entirely from Curtis Sittenfeld's imagination. That, I mean, that's complicated. And I think, I have, like, full disclaimer, I really enjoyed the book. I couldn't put it down. But the whole time, I felt a bit uncomfortable.
Because in Sittenfeld's previous novels, she'd wrote about real people, but never named them, right?
Yeah, or changed the names, kind of. So American Wife, which is one of her earlier novels, and is a brilliant book, you wouldn't know. You could read it and consider the characters completely imagined, and I guess they are, but a lot of the beats of the life story in there is similar to Laura Bush, who was married to, I want to say, the first George Bush.
George
I
one?
That's right.
I love the way you're looking at me, yes.
Yes, let's sure. just go with it. But that this is the thing about the book. It's that is a novel, and there's no, when you're reading it, you're not thinking about the real life person. You are living this imagined life with this fictional character, and that feels quite straightforward to enjoy. Whereas reading Rodham, I just kept it like, what did Hillary Clinton think of it?
Do you think she's read it?
I do not know. I mean, they put a photo of her on the cover. I'd have thought she has to approve that sort of thing. I don't know.
I would have no idea.
Yeah.
But maybe
that's
not.
So, that is so like, this is literally a book about Hillary.
Yeah, I mean, you could actually look at that and think it was non-fiction, right?
Yeah.
About her early life. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah.
In terms of memoir, life writing, non-fiction, what would you say is the kind of book that's had the biggest impact on you, or you found the most thought-provoking?
That's a really good question, and a lot of books come to mind. So stop.
You can have more than
me.
One.
I didn't really read non-fiction before I started bookselling. I always thought of it as like, you read fiction for fun and non-fiction is what you read when you're at school, and it's like a textbook. And I didn't really understand that memoir existed outside of like celebrity biographies. I think until I started bookselling, the only one I'd really tried reading is a biography of Kurt Cobain. And it's very like, he was born at this time and he weighed this much and then he did this. And then when I became a bookseller, just from unpacking the books, people asking for things, more and more memoirs kind of came into my eye line, I suppose. And the first one that really made an impact was a book called A Woman on the Edge of Time by Jeremy Gavron. And it's, he's writing about his mother, and I guess I had read things like it, but all the things I'd read like it were novels, and I didn't really realise you could write non-fiction in a way that felt like a story.
Absolutely.
And moved me like a story. So that was probably like the first one that sort of made me realise, oh, there's this whole half of literature that you have not read, and there's all this stuff out there that you can read now. And then I just read loads. I could not stop reading memoir. And another one that just blew me away and is now out of print, so I would love for someone to reissue it because I think it's wonderful. But it's called You Can't Catch Death by Ianthe Brautigan. And she's the daughter of a writer called Richard Brautigan, who is a kind of lesser-known beat writer, so kind of Jack Kerouac peer. And his books, for the most part, are still in print. But Ianthe's book is about, I guess, being his daughter and what his death by suicide, the impact it had on her life and how she thinks about it, but sort of how she also thinks about people who write about artists and death. There's so much going on in it, and it's a really short book. It's just these kind of vignettes of her memories of him and her in the aftermath of his death, and also like really beautiful writing about landscape, and there's so much going on in it. And as far as I'm aware, it's the only book she's written.
Really?
Yeah.
So one thing I'd really like to talk about is false memories.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way that we perhaps reimagine things and write them in fiction. Can we talk a bit about that?
Definitely, yes. There's so, if you've ever heard me speak about books before, you've probably heard me talk about Sarah Paretsky, who is a crime writer that I absolutely adore, and has written this series of books. Is still writing this series of books. Mm-hmm. She's on like book 22.
No way.
Of a private detective called V.I. Warshawski, and I love them. And one of the books is called Total Recall, and it is about, so sort of context for VI, her specialism is financial crime. So most of the time the initial crime is like fraud or corruption, or someone is underpaying undocumented workers. So she's mm-hmm. kind of like going up against these big corporations. But then being crime fiction, there is also then usually a murder. And in Total Recall, it's a bit different to all the others. You've got this central character who has come forward saying he remembers things from his past, and he's recalled them with the help of this psychologist who, I think the term they use is reclaimed memory.
Sure.
And then, because it's a crime fiction novel, mm-hmm. He's got this connection to one of VI's best friends, so mm-hmm. this is how she kind of gets involved. And the question throughout the book is he telling the truth, and what's the psychologist's role in this all? Who is remembering things correctly?
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean for people in the present day thinking about things that have happened many, many years before? Like, how do we respond to it now? What do we do now about these things that may or may not be true? It's a really good crime novel that is quite different to most crime novels. Mm-hmm. It's much more sort of philosophical, I guess. And I think about it all the time.
I love a crime novel. We were having this discussion before we recorded this morning, a crime novel that isn't centred around the murder of a woman.
Yeah.
And one of the recommendations which you gave me last year was Scorched Grace, yes. which is an amazing crime series following an amateur sleuth nun in New Orleans. Oh my gosh, who's it by?
Margot Doherty.
And it's so great. I just thought I'd
it's
say,
fantastic.
Yeah, I love
yeah.
that recommendation.
I mean, if you've ever read a crime novel and thought, I would really love if the detective was like a chain-smoking, tattooed nun who's been in a queer punk band, this is the book. It's fantastic.
It really, really is. Right, so before we close off, what I would always love to hear are books that are coming out soon or recently published or that you've read this year, which we might not have heard about on the kind of mainstream vine. And actually, what I'd really like to discuss is, why don't we hear about all these great books? And this is a bigger problem in publishing, right? Why aren't we being given the truth, let's say, of all these amazing books that are coming out? That, like, is it, where is that problem?
I mean, I think sheer volume of books coming out makes it so hard for people to know about all of them. I mean, mm-hmm. it's impossible to know about all the books that are coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I suppose, I mean, I don't know a huge amount about publishing where you could probably answer these questions, but the way I understand it is you're going to have some books with a really big marketing budget
mm-hmm.
and they'll get the investment, there'll be adverts, maybe there'll be book tours, and some of the smaller books might have no budget there at all. And so it's what, is it on the author to promote
well,
them?
Yeah, and... You know, is it on the sales team? Do they have an in-house sales team? You know, are people are the sales team really behind the book? How many books do they have to push to the booksellers? Who are you? You know, because you must sit in front of reps and they get out a catalogue, right? And then there'll be some reps, I'm sure, that just come to you with like three or four top titles when you know there are more.
Yeah, yes. And actually, that's interesting. I've never really thought about this, but when I've had a really personal recommendation from a rep, when they've said, look, this book's coming out, I read it, I properly love it, they've always been brilliant and they've not necessarily been the big ones. Sometimes they are. Sometimes a book is big because it's good.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It does happen.
But yeah, there's just so many books coming out all the time, and time is limited as a bookseller. Mm-hmm. But then also you're selling books sometimes to people who don't have time to read more than maybe 5 books a year, 10 books a year. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard for them to decide what to read, apart from the ones that they see with reviews and in bestseller charts. And
yeah, absolutely. It's a path of least resistance, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what's coming out that we need to have on our radar? Okay. What absolute one book do you insist that I read before next time I see you?
Oh, have you read Headshot yet?
I have. I loved Headshot.
Okay. Good, so we can take that off the list. There's a book coming out, actually, by the time this episode comes out, I think it will be out because it's late September. It's called Neverland by Vanessa Kizule, who's a poet.
Yes.
Yeah. And this book, Neverland, is nonfiction, little bit of memoir, and she is unpacking her past and kind of still her present as a really big Michael Jackson fan. And she's looking at kind of hero worship and how we treat celebrities, how we treat like disclosure of bad behaviour, I guess, as an umbrella term for the different artists she talks about it in it. But then also how that applies in our own lives. Like, what does it mean to accept that the people you love can do bad things? And what I like so much about the book is she's also thinking, how do we change the way we respond to them in order to make a safer community for everyone. So it seems like where we are with the kind of artists and art conversation is how we respond when we find out. Mm-hmm. But she seems very interested in what you do before that point. Like, what do you do to make creative industries safer for people and therefore better?
That sounds amazing.
It is brilliant. It's really good. And because she's a poet, it's also beautifully written. Mm-hmm. And I think what I really liked about it is kind of what I hope we've done in our conversation, is it's been open. It's been the start of a conversation without answers. There's not necessarily like, this is what I think everyone should do. This thing is true. This thing is not true. And that's always going to be the case. And you either agree with me and that's fine, or you're wrong, kind of thing. And instead, it feels like asking a lot of questions and the work of answering the questions is the next bit of the book.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing, actually, because so much of everything these days feels really black and white, and it feels like we're all existing in these echo chambers and we're not asking questions and we're not provoking debate. And I know that I'm guilty of, you know what, sometimes just taking a back seat and thinking, you know what, I'm not going to open that because it feels like a can of worms, because people aren't willing to have conversations around things anymore. It's just a no, you're wrong, no, you're this, no, I hate you, and that's kind of it. And I think often the work of nonfiction, but also the work of fiction, really opens that up.
Yeah, definitely. And I think these kind of long form bits of writing are a really good place to think about these things, because the other places we have these conversations are set up to fuel arguments, like to get responses to things. You don't have much time to form a nuanced argument in a tweet, because there's literally a character limit. And arguments will make things more visible, and so you'll see the things that where people are having friction and possibly not saying exactly what they want to say, because it's kind of impossible to hold all the nuance unless you've got the time to think it through and be kind of honest about your flaws and include all of that in the argument. And I think that's a very good way of approaching this. Like, you don't, no one's perfect. Somebody that wants to tackle the question of Michael Jackson, for example, then they're not a perfect person. And that's okay. Like, they're going to think about this big topic that it's really important we all have a conversation about, but it doesn't mean each person has to be completely flawless, because no one is. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. And feels like a really nice way to end it on, despite the fact that I could sit and talk to you about books maybe for the rest of my life and I'd be very happy. Elizabeth, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for your wonderful recommendations and the thought-provoking conversation.
Thank you very much for having me back.
So for anyone listening who has enjoyed what Elizabeth has said and wants to hear more about her takes on books and recommendations, how can they sign up to your Substack?
So you don't have to have a Substack account. You can just head to substack.shelfimprovement.com.
Just search Shelf Improvement,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and you can find it through my Instagram, which is ec.reads. But if you are a Substack app user, first of all, can you explain to me how it works? I find it very confusing. But you can find it on there if you search Shelf Improvement.
Thank you so much. I am really excited to be joined for the second month in a row by Brighton-based poet Aflo the Poet, who is here with a slightly different hat on from last month to talk about the residency which they are doing in collaboration with the Brighton Dome called Status Flow. Welcome back.
Hi, Anna. Thanks so much for having me. It's good to chat to you again.
So how did this come about?
I have been fortunate enough to be an in-house artist at Brighton Dome for 2023-2024. Wonderful program. It meant that I got access to their new space, Anita's room, to develop my practice a bit more. But Status Flow is my legacy project, so something that will continue at the Dome now that my residency has come to an end. So blessed to be doing it in the Studio Theatre and to be bringing Poetry Nights back to the Studio Theatre after their 7-year hiatus during the refurbishment. So yeah, exciting times.
Absolutely, 7 years. And you are bringing in some really exciting voices in poetry from Sussex and the Brighton area and beyond. What can we expect for your events in October?
Yes, so the setup for Status Flow will always be that there is a local feature artist as well as a national feature artist. So for October, locally, we have the marvellous Mally, who is Mally's Diaries on Instagram, if you want to check out their work. Really excited to have Mally on board. They're a wonderful, young, multidisciplinary creative, and it's been a joy to see them flourishing in the last year or so. So yeah, that would be great to have Mally there, who will also be joined by the gorgeous, wonderful human that is Tyrone Horton. I first met Tyrone last year at Brighton Book Festival. He's the author of Poetry Book Hoods, which is an amazing, really in-depth, emotional exploration around the themes of masculinity, fatherhood, racism, and all those things combined into one. Tyrone is based in Leicester, had the privilege of featuring at one of his events in Leicester back in July. So I'm really happy that I get to spend time with him again, because he really is a joy. If you haven't come across his work, I definitely recommend it, because he is punchy and powerful. Yeah, it's going to be a great night.
It is going to be a great night. And what date is it?
October the 21st. It's a Monday. Wonderful way to kickstart your week.
Absolutely. And although I know that the lineup has yet to be announced for December, you have the dates, right?
Yeah, so December, we are a bit earlier, 2nd of December. And yeah, Top Secret, who our artists are, but keep an eye out because it's going to be another fire one.
So I think many people feel that poetry isn't really for them. They don't understand it. They don't get it. They kind of feel really like it's quite difficult to be involved. What would you say to someone that felt like that?
Well, I would say I totally get where you're coming from because I felt the same. In 2018, I went to my first spoken word show. And before that, if you'd asked if I liked poetry, I would have told you no. No, I don't. I was not interested at school. I didn't find anything that kind of pricked my ears. But in 2018, I went to see Travis Alabanza. I'd followed their kind of activism work online for years and I hadn't come across their poetry, but I just really wanted to see them and be in the room with them. And they were supported by Sabira, amazing local artist who featured in our September edition of Status Flow. It's so great to share space again with Sabira now because they were part of that first event for me that really opened my eyes to spoken word. The way that they kind of spoke about their own lived experiences and perspectives, but with a sense of rhythm and flow, it lit a fire beneath me to kind of to share the things that I wanted to share in the form that I wanted to share them in. We're told at school that poetry has all these rules and stuff that you're supposed to follow, and that is not my kind of game. Like, I'm sure I've probably said this to you before, Anna, but I don't know what a sonnet is. It's one of my taglines. Don't know what a sonnet is, and please don't tell me. I don't need to know in order to be a poet, and I hope that I demonstrate that. Poetry can be one word, or it could be a whole conscious stream of rambling thought that doesn't even need to make sense and it doesn't need to rhyme. It can be whatever you need it to be, and so there really is something for everyone.
Oh, thank you so much. That feels really reassuring, actually. So I know that there is an open mic element to Status Flow. Please, can you talk a bit about that?
I've developed the tradition from our kind of tester poetry nights at the Dome earlier this year and towards the end of last year, of collectively with the audience, we select about five random words, and then during the break, people have the opportunity to write something, and at the end, there's space for people to come and share their work if they so choose. I love setting the challenge of here are these words that we've collectively chosen together, but seeing how differently people interpret them or the common themes that come up as well. Like, it's interpretation which can kind of lead to all these different paths in life, but there's also something that connects us. And I really just wanted to include something where people could have the opportunity to come up on the mic at Brighton Dome because, wow, what a prestigious, legendary venue. I remember the first poetry night I did there. Someone shared a poem on the stage who had never shared a poem on a stage before. And like, for that to be your first time is like, wow. Wow. So yeah, it's called Status Flow because we're all about challenging the status quo. So it's important to have that element of anyone can be up on this stage. It could be you. It could be you listening right now.
Is there an age limit to who can come?
There's no official age range, but I would say around 15, 16 plus. There can be some really heavy themes, but everything is given with content warnings and trigger warnings where necessary. So yeah, we're open to all, but there are some heavy themes.
Thank you so much. So before you go, Aflo, I would love it if you could actually read us a couple of poems. I know you wrote one for the Dome, which was commissioned by the Dome. And I think as you are doing Status Quo, it'd be really great to hear that one. And then maybe hear another one of yours for the road, because we do love your work here at the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you, Anna. Okay. I wrote this piece for the Dome. It's called Welcome Home to and from Brighton Dome. And this was as part of their reopening with the Studio Theatre and the Corn Exchange. So this is it. After being pushed back, our walls have come down. Curtains call, we step forwards, red carpets rolled out, arms outstretched to embrace artists and all of their crowds. No need to gatekeep or rein it in. In this house, all can wear their crowns. Greeted by Ceres, a goddess whose purpose is to grow and produce, we offer our stages, our spaces, our jewels. For our creatives and communities to access and use, we are amplifying artists and increasing in volumes. From monarchical to marginalized, we take pride in repurposing relics and intentionally making strides to uplift and reach beyond glass ceilings. While beneath exposed beams, we incubate dreams of arts and culture to keep our city's heart beating. Suffrage, shorelines, and water illuminate us, but the people in our grounds are the royalty that makes us shine. An active past so subversive, now refurbished and restored, rebuilt for purpose and purposely reborn, historic consideration for stardust and modern magic. Welcome home to and from Brighton Dome. This is the People's Palace.
That is so lovely, Aflo. They must have been delighted with that.
Oh, it was really lovely. All the wonderful feedback I've gotten from people working all across the Dome in response to that poem. It is on the wall on the way into the Studio Theatre as well, which is just amazing. Like, you know, I did my undergrad at Brighton Uni. I graduated on the stage at Brighton Dome, and I had no idea or any intention or dream even of walking across that stage again, let alone feeling so at home in such a monumental space. Like, the Dome are wonderful. They are amazing. And if you're an emerging artist, I encourage you to get in touch with them to see how they might be able to support you.
Thank you so much, Aflo. And I would love to hear your poem, Connect Four, please. I think it's really great. It's really powerful. And the story behind it, I think, is really important for all of our listeners.
Thanks, Anna. Yes, this is one that I wrote earlier this year on the 4th anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. For me, it feels super important to always keep this activism as a part of my work. Not that that comes unnaturally to me, but my whole story and experience, like, I wouldn't be talking to you today. I wouldn't be doing anything at the Dome, I think, if George Floyd hadn't been murdered and there wasn't the BLM uprising and anti-racist response. I had never had paid work as an artist before this. It's only, I think, well, not only, you know, I don't want to deny that I have some level of talent, but in terms of the opportunities that have been made available to me, I really don't think that any of that would have happened if there wasn't this focus on anti-racism at this particular time. And so, yeah, it's a thread that continues throughout my work, and I will continue to share that wherever I can. So thank you for inviting me to do this piece, Connect Four. Here I'm kind of trying to connect all of the well, not all, but a lot of the painful issues and atrocities going on around the world today. So trigger warnings for mentions of genocide, violence, general heavy themes. This is Connect Four. There is no forgetting. 4 years ago, black squares upon phones, plenty of people and placards upon roads rising up across the globe. From Minneapolis to Palestine, shouting justice for black lives, screaming freedom for all colonized, pleading we just want a change and now is the time. We can't afford to wait no more, so now could be the time, and the temperature is rising, can't keep up with the climate. Poisons rolling on the tides, and so many bellies emptied and unsatisfied, and still demanding free, free Palestine while Sudan bleeds and Tigray cries. I'm so sick of watching genocides and children shaken and traumatized or burnt or beheaded or buried alive, whether under Israeli-made rubble or digging deep in Congolese cobalt mines so we can see these scenes on lithium battery-powered pocket screens shattered. I can't breathe. As Malcolm X said, there are no chips on our shoulders. There are knees on our necks. The weight of history is heavy, but hold strong. And don't forget to raise your fist and raise your voice, because silence is neither an option nor a choice. We remember the murdered and the martyred, and rest in power, George Floyd.
Thank you so much, Aflo. I love that poem. I think it's wonderful. And I think the story behind it is really important, and one that I'm sure you'll keep telling throughout your career, actually.
I know it can feel overwhelming when we start to connect all these things, but what can be so, the best tonic for that is to then build more connections between ourselves and other people and our communities, you know. So I feel so blessed and so grateful for opportunities such as Status Flow, such as The Coast is Queer, and these chats with you, and more opportunities for us to come together and move towards something different. So thanks for having me back for another chat, and I look forward to seeing you very soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. You can get tickets to see Aflo at Status Flow from the Brighton Dome website. Thank you so much for listening to the Brighton Book Club. We will be back next month with more books and writing and news from local writers and authors in Brighton and beyond. Make sure you follow us over on Instagram at BTM Book Club and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get yours. We will see you next month.